Hey everyone, this is Carrie the Metal Geek checking in the beginning of this episode. We recorded this episode last week before the hurricane hit our area. I wanted to give a quick update for our fans and our listeners for MSRcast and the Metal Geeks podcast. We are good here. The only bad thing that happened at my location was some AC problems. Extremely lucky. We are very, very lucky. A lot of my friends and fellow Houstonians are not so lucky. So let's go through the list of our friends of the show and our co-host. Sean, the Metal Pigeon, is doing well. He is staying dry and safe. Houston is starting to come back to life. We just got some sun and things are starting to pick up. Things are starting to open up again. But there's still a lot of problems in the next few days, weeks, months in the city. So if you want to donate, I'm going to go on a little tangent here. If you want to donate to the Red Cross, donate to the Hurricane Harvey relief. It's definitely needed down here. Dave, our co-host on the Metal Geeks podcast, is doing well. His family is safe. George is doing well. He was in a mandatory evacuation area where they had to release water, but he is safe at family's house. Justin, our friend of the show, is doing well. Bill is doing well up where he's at, up north in Texas, in Houston, and he's safe. All of our co-hosts and all of our friends are safe right now, and we are extremely lucky. We have a lot of friends who are not safe, they're safe, but you know, they've had a lot of problems, a lot of things happening to them. This episode of MSRcast, we have our friend of the show, guitar player from Blues Funeral. This was all done, of course, before the hurricane hit. And the drummer from Blues Funeral, Corey Cousins, good friend of the show, good friend of ours, had his house flooded. And there is a GoFundMe that was started for him. So if you can help him out, $5, $20, whatever you have, if you enjoy their music, if you know you want to support the local metal scene, which I'm sure there's going to be a lot of things happening soon with the local metal scene, and I definitely want to be involved with that. Go to our Facebook page. There is a link to his GoFundMe account. Donate whatever you can. Donate whatever you can to the hurricane relief. It's been a hard week. It's been very difficult for a lot of people. So if you listen to the show and you've been watching stuff on the news, donate what you can. If you can't, we appreciate your support as well. So now on to the show. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of MSRcast. We are good here. We are all safe. And we look forward to bringing you some more metal. So check out this episode of MSRcast and we will see you guys soon. Thanks.
For over 10 years, we've been bringing you killer metal music and frank discussions about heavy metal. Wait, who the hell is Frank? You are tuned into MSRcast, brought to you by Mainstream Resistance. Here are your hosts, Kerry the Metal Geek and Sean the Metal Pigeon. Keep it metal.
Welcome, my friends, to episode number 197 of the MSRcast Metal Podcast. I am one of your hosts. I am Kerry the Metal Geek, along with
Sean. They sometimes call me the Metal Pigeon.
Everybody calls you the Metal Pigeon.
That's
when you're
true.
Talking
Everyone
about you, no,
the Metal Pigeon.
You came up with that name, so
I
right?
I no, I didn't.
Who came up with that?
I can't remember, but it wasn't me.
But you stuck with it.
But I stuck with it. Yeah,
there you go.
Yeah, I came up with the name. I'm there taking credit for it.
Taking that shit back.
Yeah.
Joining us this evening, it's a good friend of the show. It's Maurice from Blues Funeral. Welcome, sir, to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Of course, man. So we're going to talk about your new album and all that good stuff, and we're going to play some new tracks. We've brought so much music to the table tonight. This is going to be a two-parter.
Fantastic.
You brought a lot of bands that you've done it to us again, man. You've brought a lot of bands to the table we've never fucking heard of before. We're like, what is this? All right, sounds good. So we're going to get into that. So what's been going on with you, man? What have you been up to, Sean? The Metal Pigeon. I have to say it every time like that.
Listening to music. I went to one of the weirdest metal shows I've ever been to in my life.
What was that?
A couple weeks ago. I went to go see Theocracy at BFE Rock Club.
How was Theocracy?
They were fun. The sounds was a little rough. They were a little rough. It was their first show like in months and months and months.
Yeah.
This is not a tour. They just did two experimental shows in Texas just to see if anyone would show up.
Why in Texas?
They just got the offer in Texas. And he was even saying, he's like, yeah, we just got invited here. And
so I haven't heard of these cats. What's the genre?
They're a power metal band. They're from Atlanta. They're an American power metal band, but they play like they're from Germany. They play in the European Halloween mode.
Okay.
And they sort of have a Christian undertone to their lyrics, or
hence
overtone.
The name. Yeah.
And
I was going to ask.
And the weird part about the show was that this is the first time I've been to a metal show where people weren't throwing the horns up. They were doing
they didn't know what to do.
They were doing the worship like open hand thing. And that freaked me out. And there was a biker gang there. The biker gang was these guys were from Soldiers of Christ. They had like the jackets on and they're like really tough looking guys.
So this is an MC called Soldiers of Christ?
Biker gang.
Yeah, so well, yeah, an MC motorcycle club,
yeah. But yeah,
you don't watch that much Sons of Anarchy, Sean.
No, but it was just one of the most surreal shows, and one of the opening bands was. Did I talk about this already? No, I haven't talked.
We talked about it personally. I don't think we talked about it on
that's
the show.
Right. Okay, but one of the opening bands was Millennial Rain, who the vocalist was tremendous. He sounded like a mix of Ronnie James Dio and Jeff Tate.
So they're only good. The beginning part of the millennium, that's when they reign?
Well, okay, so he explained the name from
so
stage.
So now, 17 years later, they're done.
He explains the name from stage. He says it's a Bible verse, and he encourages the crowd to go and read the Bible verse. And
did
I'm
you
just
feel sorry. Very uncomfortable at this show?
I felt extremely uncomfortable.
What metal shirt were you wearing?
Deicide.
I was wearing I can't remember. I was Swallow the Sun shirt. Yeah, okay. That's right. And
it reminds me of the story of like seeing the only time I ever saw Tenacious D. Kim, my wife, was wearing a goat horse shirt and had a big fucking demon and shit on it.
Right.
And this is before we knew what, you know, hipsters were. This group of people, like young girls and guys, making comments about the demon goat on her shirt. I turned around, I was like, look at the fucking stage. Did you see a huge demon goat on stage? What the hell are you talking about? It was very, very awkward like that.
Huh, like they were making comments behind your back or something?
Yeah, I heard it turn around. I was like, look at the fucking stage. You're seeing Tenacious D. Do you not know where you're at?
Where going, yeah. Kind of in direct opposition to that. Once I went to a Morbid Angel concert in San Antonio.
I'm sorry.
Whoa. I'm not.
Depends on which Morbid Angel.
Well, it was David Vincent, Morbid Angel, and he was basically playing everything off A through D. So it was a good show. It was right after he had just rejoined the band. But so we went, and it was a co-headlining show with Soulfly. So that's the part where you can say,
weird.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Okay.
But a buddy of mine thought it would be hilarious to wear a shirt with a Jesus fish on it that said Property of Jesus. And everybody at the show seemed to find that amusing. So
Christian metal is, I'm not against it. But I love Theocracy so much, I was willing to just kind of just like, all right, whatever. You know, hey, I'm sure it's going to be just a good power metal crowd. It wasn't the typical power metal crowd. It was a strange show. I was in an unfamiliar venue, first of all. I've only been to BFE once before, and they had changed it since then. Have you ever been there?
To BFE, yeah, a couple times. Seen Absu up there, Incantation.
It's a weird venue.
It is a weird venue.
Just the way it's structured kind of bothers
me. It's like a club, right? I mean, like a bar type
it's
of
like
situation?
It's like a bar that has no business being a venue, in my opinion. I'm not
I
trying
think
to talk
I've
back
seen
about
James
it.
Rivera there one time.
Yeah. That's probably true.
In the kind of a sketchy neighborhood.
Destruction and Sepultura were playing there.
Jesus.
Damn.
I left for Sepultura. I caught like two songs and then left. I'm not a fan of their new direction, but... It's an interesting venue because, like, to your point, I feel like the stage area feels like a long hallway almost, especially when it's packed.
Right, yeah.
And the bar is just sort of, like, in the way.
Yeah.
And then there's, like, this little alcove around behind the bar that's, like, awkward. And it's, like, if you have to be back there, you can't actually see anything that's happening.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, welcome to the Obscure Metal Clubs in Houston podcast.
But yeah, anyway, the Millennial Rain singer, he was a great vocalist.
Yeah.
And I met him after the show, and I was like, hey, great job, because I really did like his vocals, right? And he's like, oh, thanks, brother, thanks, brother.
Did he try to
God bless
you,
man. No. And I was just like, wow, whoa, where am I at? So it was just a strange show. I did meet Rusty.
Hail Satan.
Rusty O'Connor. O'Connor? Or Rusty Connor.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Who's the manager for Sui Dakra. So I did meet him up there. He was
He's
the
manager for Sui Dakra?
The tour. I think he's their tour manager, yeah.
He does. He used to do the a magazine.
Oh, yeah?
Wow. All right.
He knew you. I mean, I know that when I... When Arcadius was on vacation, a couple, like last year around November, he came to Houston and he stayed with Rusty for a while and they went to the Texas Renaissance Festival. And like, that's how Arcadius is a big Houston Texans fan and stuff like that. So there's some weird Houston connection between us and Sui Dakra. So,
interesting.
Yeah.
So what have you been up to since the last time you've been on the show?
Oh man, it's
only been 2 years. I want to hear day by day recap.
Day by day, probably like from the last time I left this room, we were already fast at work on the second album. That's obviously about to get released on Friday.
I have it here in my hand.
Yeah. And actually, since then, hilariously enough, the third album's actually already basically written.
What? Already?
Yeah.
Wow.
So our plan is to kind of try to follow a similar timeline, kind of get everything worked out. You know, playing some live shows over the next year and have it arranged and ready to go to hit the studio again probably sometime next May. But we already have 6 tracks that we're pretty confident.
So we're going to get into the album because after the next set of music, we're going to actually play a brand new track.
Oh, cool.
And we're going to talk about the process and the album and all that good stuff. But me and you were at a show this past weekend.
We were, dude. Deep Purple, Alice Cooper, and the Edgar Winter Band.
Yep. I barely saw Edgar Winter because we got there about the same time.
At the same time, yeah. I think they were playing Hoochie Coo and sounded great from the parking lot even. I was shocked. I was like, man, Edgar Winter's 70, but he sounds massive.
I love his like his keyboard.
And it's not a keytar.
No.
But he's the only guy who's basically put a strap on a full like keyboard.
Wow.
Yeah.
Dude, it was
strong. How's he holding it? Just like it's hanging off.
It's just like kind of draped around his neck basically and he's just sitting there banging on the keys.
I heard an interview with him on the radio this morning, which is weird. He's talking about making that thing. He's like, guitar players get to have all the fun. I didn't want to be the guy stuck behind a keyboard being my band.
Yeah.
I'm going to get out there into the front. I'm like, all right. But yeah, so Alice Cooper was great.
So what did you think about the ordering? It's interesting because obviously from a position of reverence and tenure, it makes sense to have Purple headline.
Right.
But I would argue that from a stage show perspective,
I would agree with your argument because
Cooper just knocked it out of the park.
No, Alice Cooper is a showman. His shows are theatrical, in nature. Everything about it, it's just amazing. We saw him last year at Bayou Music Center, it was a little bit more
intimate,
but we weren't that far. I mean, we had lawn seats, me and my wife did, so we weren't that far away from the stage. It's great. Except the camera guy during Alice Cooper was a fucking idiot.
Yeah.
Whoever was running camera, when they had like their own, they had a couple of cameras set up, so they didn't have it loose enough, so every time they would move it, it would be like that jerky movement.
Yeah.
And she's like, dude, it was enough to annoy the hell out of me having a degree in film. I was like, dude, what? You're killing me.
Yeah.
Even people around me that were like, what the hell? It became like a joke for like the whole time. But yeah, he was great. He only played one new song from the new album, which is what, Paranormal?
Yeah.
Great album, actually. It's very 70s influenced. He went back with some old songwriters and some old players because you're saying that Nita Strauss.
Yeah.
Not even on the album?
By all accounts. I mean, I just picked up the album actually very recently. I'd been meaning to get it before the show and didn't get a chance to actually until after. So just a few days ago, I went into Soundwaves, picked up a copy, was scoping the liner notes, and was shocked to see that I didn't see Nita anywhere in...
Interesting.
I mean, I'll look again. I'll print a retraction or whatever if I'm wrong, but I don't think she's on the album. Now, you did a 2-CD with some live stuff, and obviously she's in the live stuff, but I guess he's treating her as more of a hired gun than...
Well, he's always sort of done that recently.
I guess that's true.
Is he not... So, is he just retreating from the metal style completely? Because he seemed pretty heavy.
I wouldn't say he's retreating from the metal style, but definitely, to Carrie's point, I think there is a reverence and certainly a concerted effort to kind of pay some homage to that earlier Cooper kind of feel... still in a modern context, though.
Yeah.
We were kind of having the argument before, you know, we started talking now. And I think that part of the reason that he hasn't put Nita in is just because her sort of technical dexterity, et cetera, is a little bit more modern and lends itself to more modern vibe that I think it probably,
right,
he probably feels like it, maybe it would have overshadowed some of the old stuff.
You are right. So I'm looking at the personnel on the Alice Cooper album. You have Alice Cooper, Tommy Henriksen, Larry Mullen Jr., who's the drummer from U2, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. Bob Ezrin, production, keyboard, Roger Glover, Billy Gibbons.
Yeah, Gibbons has a guest spot on the album.
A lot of other people, and then there's a couple tracks with original members of his band, Michael Bruce and Neil Smith, Dennis Dunaway, Steve Hunter. But yeah, the only thing with Nita Strauss was some live stuff that were bonus tracks.
Yeah.
Interesting.
It is. I mean, and it's a great album. I'm kind of bummed because definitely I feel the live show has been taken next level with Nita on stage. She's amazing.
And the song they played from the album, it's great. It's catchy as hell.
Yeah.
Paranoid Personality, whatever it is. Man. Check it out on Spotify or YouTube and all those good places. Alice Cooper deserves to be where he's at. You know what I mean?
Definitely.
But I definitely agree. He deserved to headline the show.
I just think from an overall
different energy
stage presence perspective, like that would have closed the night out with a huge bang from an energy perspective. Now, that said, Purple got up and killed it.
They killed it. So this is more of like it's a co-headlining show. And I've seen a lot of metal shows when they do the co-headlining, they'll switch back and forth. But I don't think they do that on this tour.
Yeah. I'm guessing it's out of respect on some level that, you know, it's Deep Purple after all. But I guess the only complaint that I have is I would have liked for them to have gone back and done some of the deeper cuts. And I would have, I know it's probably asking too much with Ian Gillan helming the band to go back and do some Coverdale era Purple.
Nope.
But I wanted some Burn, some Mistreated, some Sail Away, some Stormbringer.
Yeah.
Soldier of Fortune.
I don't think they're going to do that.
Yeah, probably not.
They did play some. They played some classic tracks.
No, they did. We got Fireball, Perfect Strangers, Hush, Soldier. Yeah. Smoke on the Water. I keep saying Soldier of Fortune because I really wanted them to play that.
Knocking on your door, which was the second night they've ever played this on this tour. They just added it back in. I was like, that's cool.
Yeah.
It was a good show.
It was a good show. And I mean, you kind of have to think about it this way. I can't remember who I was talking to, but I think this is right. You have to realize how much time Steve Morse has spent in the band as a guitar player now. It's almost a little bit unfair to not play a heavy amount of new material, given how much he's played on.
Right.
Because then it's basically like saying, hey, Steve, play in this like Ritchie Blackmore cover band for us real quick.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, it's great, but it's also got to feel a little bit limiting as a guitar player. So.
And I want to call him the new keyboardist, but Don Airey.
Don Airey's amazing.
He's a badass.
Dude, he was killing it on stage.
He really was. If you like a lot of keyboard and organ wankery, that came out wrong. No organ wankery
organ
on
wankery,
stage.
Yeah, well, we all like that.
Yeah, Deep Purple, they fucking killed it.
Yeah.
And like we were talking about before the show, I know there's a lot of their stuff, but I have not been, I didn't turn into a big fan until sort of like recently, and like a big fan, you know what I mean?
Of Purple, yeah.
So I was like, I'm going to get tickets to see him, and it's going to be awesome. It was fun.
Yeah, no, it was
a lot of fun.
It was a great show.
So let's play a song from Deep Purple.
Let's do it.
First time ever on MSRcast, I believe.
Oh, really?
This is from the 1984 album. This is the title track from
Perfect Strangers.
I think this song, it's probably in my top 10 songs of all time.
And they played it.
And they did play it. And the annoying guys, I sort of touched upon this before we started recording. There's this group of guys that were about 10 feet away from me on the lawn, smoking out, drinking way too much beer. One of the dudes was whistling the entire time. It's, you know, fingers in his mouth, whistling loud. And it's okay if you do that when... Here's the rules on that, right? I'm going to make these rules up, and you got to adhere to it. If you want to whistle at a band because you're having a good time, do it like at the end of a song. Don't do it the entirety of every song they play, because it fucking annoys the people around you.
That's true.
It's like a regular Klaus Meine.
But luckily, they got up to go get some more beer right before Perfect Stranger started.
Perfect.
They came back right at the end of the song. I was like, good timing.
Good timing for the song, because they were strangers to you, and it was perfect that they left when the song came on.
Motherfuckers, that's
right.
They
were perfect strangers.
They were perfect strangers. There's nothing perfect about those dudes. Let's check out Perfect Strangers from Deep Purple. I think this is the first time we've ever played this band on the show. So check it out and rock out.
Oh, yeah.
Remember. It's just a small step for mankind. Ooh, I'm breaking through on shattered ground. Ooh, a journey from the safe and sound.
Episode 197 of MSRcast, and we just got finished listening to a band that I've never heard of before, a band called Sienna Root that Maurice had brought to the table. Tell me about this band.
Yeah, so these guys are interesting. They formed in Sweden like back in the 90s. They've been around for a while. Actually just put out a new record this year called A Dream of Lasting Peace. Super awesome record. You know, as you could probably hear in the sound, and a great pairing with Purple. They sound they've got a heavy dose of Purple, especially with the organ playing. The vocals are very, you know, old school, etc. But they also have a little bit of that, I don't know, mysticism, if you will, that more modern bands like Witchcraft have kind of brought to the table. And you
I
know,
can see that.
in the middle of that too, some flourishes of stuff like Blue Oyster Cult. I really love these guys. The record they put out this year, I think, is easily top 10 material for me.
This is very cool. And where are they from again?
Sweden.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course they are.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like this style of music lends itself so well to that part of the world for whatever reason. There's so much of it that seems to come out of there. Graveyard, guys like this, witchcraft. I mean, it's endless.
I did an interview the other day with local comic book store. There's a comic out there called Rock Stars. If you haven't heard about it, it's really, really cool. One of the guys, the writer is a guy named Joe Harris, who did he does like the X-Files comics,
mm-hmm.
and yeah. He also wrote he's a script writer too. Have you ever seen that movie Darkness Falls? He wrote that movie.
Oh, cool.
And then the artist is a girl named Megan Hutchinson, and she was like all into like fucking Baphomet and like evil black metal stuff, and she was super cool. They're both really cool. But when I went in, I was wearing my Amorphis shirt, and she was like, "Who's that?" And I was like, "It's the best band from Finland you'll ever hear." She's like, "I'm gonna check them out." But they're really cool. I did an interview with them. It'll be on the next episode of Metal Geeks. But the first volume, the first five issues of this comic, it's sort of like a group of people, kids that investigate like weird stuff going on, but it all ties into music. So like the first five issues it's like all classic rock type stuff. So Deep Purple,
cool,
and Led Zeppelin and all this kind of stuff. And then the second volume, which just started, which is with issue six, it's all about heavy metal. So it's Children of the Beast is the actual subtitle of this part.
Nice.
Really awesome. Check out the episode the interview on the next episode of Metal Geeks, but check it out, the comic. It's really, really cool.
Very cool.
It just reminded me of that. Pretty metal. Metal comic books are pretty cool, you know?
Yeah. I came across that old Guns N' Roses comic book.
Oh, yeah.
That actually came out like 91 or something.
I have
like
that still somewhere. There was an Anthrax one. There was a Metallica. And
they're
Megadeth.
Just the worst. Just the storylines are the worst in those things, but they're still cool.
The guy Joe Harris, which I didn't know this beforehand, the writer, he worked on the Alice Cooper Welcome to My Nightmare that came out like a few years ago.
Oh, cool.
I was like, I wish I'd known that. I would have actually picked that up to get him to sign it, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah. So this next band on the list, can you tell me about these guys?
Yeah. So this is the first track on the new album that we're releasing on Friday at a CD release show at White Oak. With some buddies of ours here in Houston, Doomstress and Fiddle Witch and the Demons of Doom. But this is the opening track off of Blues Funeral's new record. This song, to me, is right at home, actually, following the first two that we just played, because the vibe on this track is very 60s, 70s, not necessarily intentionally so, but that's just what tends to happen, I think, with the direction that we've pushed ourselves in with the band. Some really cool stuff in this track that was, I guess, a bit of a new thing for us. We actually have clean piano on this track, and it's almost like an unaccompanied guitar solo because it's just clean piano and guitar together, kind of creating an interesting vibe. And then the organ plays a huge part in this song, gives it a real purple, you know, kind of feel to it. Jan has a great solo that I think does John Lord proud. So
very cool.
We're pretty happy about it.
So let's talk about the album. So your first album just came out like last year.
Yeah.
So what's the process for you guys? How long does it take for you guys to sit down and say, hey, and you already mentioned you already have stuff for a third album already.
Yeah.
What is your writing process? How long does it take you guys to actually get something down?
So it's been kind of interesting. Moving into this project has been very freeing in a lot of ways, because even though Blues Funeral has sort of found its sound in a firm rooting, if you will, in the 60s and 70s, there's no sort of self-imposed limitation on what can happen musically in the band. That was something I think we all realized on the first record, that the gap from the first track, Autumn Dream, which you had a hand in helping us out with some of the video production for that when we were doing a little teaser, it's very psychedelic, it's very kind of chilled out, to Palmdale, the album closer, which is bordering thrash at times with kind of how heavy it is and sort of the speed.
I think that's the beauty of having you guys all together, because everybody has different styles. You guys are fans of different styles of music, especially you. just being on this show, how many bands that you listen to, and all those influences will come in to your writing style. And then, you know, Jan's writing style, and then Corey, your drummer. Everybody has their own style, and it all, when you get together, you can hear it in the music.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And so I think from...
I'm not blowing smoke up your ass either.
I really appreciate it, man. From that standpoint, though, from our perspective, it's just been so freeing. It's led to, I think, just a certain amount of desire to write. You know what I mean? Like a certain prolific kind of vibe. So we had the first album done. It was recorded and basically being mastered by the time that we had already started working on material for the second record and had a lot of it down. At the CD release show for the first album, we actually ended up playing two tracks that ended up on this record. Now, like, since the time that's elapsed since then and what shows up on the album, things have changed. Elements got added through arranging, through just studio experimentation, whatever. But that's kind of been the trend. Like, we've sort of, as records are being developed, we're also simultaneously writing for other stuff. And we're sharing it on the side and kind of talking about, okay, this is going to end up on this record for these reasons. This is going to end up on another record later on. But it's just been a very sort of prolific writing process. I think for both, especially Jan and I, who kind of 50-50 shape the majority of the musical direction, and then Corey and Gabe really fill it in with the rhythm section.
And during this time period, you also had a sort of a reunion from your previous band, Sanctus Bellum.
Yeah.
Done a couple shows.
Feels like just a few weeks ago, we played a show with Hellstar at White Oak. That was a blast. And that's been kind of an interesting thing, too, because, you know, if you talk to us about how we feel about Blues Funeral, I mean, it's obviously it's our main focus. And from a writing perspective, like I said, it's just been super freeing. But the fun thing about getting together with the Bellum crew is there's a brotherhood that has, you know, been forged through years of playing together, having played shows, you know, in Baltimore and Wisconsin and different parts of Texas, whatever. So getting back together, now it's just kind of like there's a lot less pressure because the material is there and it's just sort of like, hey, we're going to do this thing to kind of get back together, have some fun, play some tunes with our friends, and just get out there and pay homage to the music that we wrote. So it just becomes kind of a party. And a lot of the pressure goes away, and then it's just fun, which is cool.
You're not thinking about where the tour is going to come from or the next album for that, you know?
Not really for Bellum, not right now.
Right.
At a certain point in time, maybe. You know, I know Ben would love it if we could put another album together. It's just, frankly, it's taken a little bit of a backseat to everybody's other priorities now. Corey is doing double duty because he's playing drums for us, but he's also playing drums for Plow. And Mr. Plow is going to hit the studio in September to put out a new record. So there's a lot of creativity that's happening in these, you know, various outlets.
Best local band named after a Simpsons reference.
Yeah. And they did a song, or they're going to have a song on the new record that's a tribute to Bill Paxton, which I think is pretty
awesome.
Amusing. Yeah. It's pretty sweet, yeah.
That's awesome. That's very cool. Let's get back to the Blues Funeral. So the album's called Awakening. I'm looking at the cover right here.
First of all...
Yeah.
Because I was bitching about this on the last Metal Geeks that I was guesting on. Thank you for not releasing this in the jewel case format and giving us something worth buying. Because, like, I love physical albums, but, like, okay, the new November's Doom came out and it's only released in a jewel case.
Yeah.
That pisses me off. I like stuff like this that's, like, textile and it's, like, it's more than
Digipack
a jewel case.
It's
a piece of art.
It's beautiful.
And the cover art is... fantastic, by the way.
Thanks. So, yeah. So David Paul Seymour, who did the cover art for the last record, did the art for this one.
Can I tell you what the first thing reminds me of when I look at it? Swamp Thing.
The color choice and definitely like kind of the murkiness and the texture detail that he put on that. He told me that he got a lot of the inspiration from the title track and just kind of wanting to depict something that was otherworldly. There's lyrics in the chorus about, you know... well, not really the chorus, I guess it's more of a verse, but walking on dark waters and like traversing the land. So this kind of spiritual journey. Well, the cool thing is actually the entire foreground of the image is an abstraction of a skull. You kind of have to look at it just the right way.
I can see that.
Yeah, it's kind of unique.
And I can see some weird faces in the moss, whatever that stuff is.
Yeah.
Where can people, let's talk about where people can grab this, where they can look at what you're talking about right now.
Yeah, for sure. So we're going to have it up on Bandcamp by the end of the week, obviously, to coincide with the release.
So that's bluefuneral.bandcamp.com?
I think so, yeah.
Come on. You didn't come prepared.
Hold on. Let me just Google my own Bandcamp, and we'll get actual up-to-the-minute.
We're going to have it in our notes, too.
Check out the show notes at metalgeeks.net, and we will link to where you could pick up a copy for yourself.
But yeah, so we'll have it on the Blues Funeral Bandcamp, which is bluesfuneral.bandcamp.com. Thank you, Carrie. And we'll have it on Amazon, Spotify, you know, iTunes for streaming, all that kind of stuff. We'll have physical copies. CD Baby, we'll have some physical copies. And then I think Shadow Kingdom Records is actually going to have some copies of this and the first album available for distribution.
And if you're in the local Houston area, you guys play around a lot, so you will have these at shows.
Exactly.
If I don't know exactly when, if this goes out before Friday, you're having a CD release party that I will be at. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah. The other bands on the bill are great. Doomstress, Fiddle Witch, and the Demons of Doom. So it's going to be a nice kind of eclectic mix of sounds and just a crushing night for sure.
So tell me about the song we're going to play a little bit.
So this song was actually written, I think, right around, say, February or March of 2015, almost in its entirety.
That's too old to play, I'm sorry.
And it started off with kind of the intro guitar riff being, like, the main focal point. I wanted it to sort of, from a song perspective, have a little bit more space and be a little more chordal to give room to the other instruments to kind of add in their own feel. So the organ is a huge part of this song. Like, without the organ, the song withers and dies. And Gabe's bass, frankly, just blew me away on this track. He, in the studio, did me kind of a personal favor and played with a bass that I have. It's a 70s Ibanez lawsuit copy of a Rickenbacker. They were making them in Japan at the time, and it looks just like a Rickenbacker. Has some really great, like, old school pickups.
Yeah,
we threw on some Rotosound flat wound strings on it, and then kind of dialed the tone knob back a little bit to get sort of a John Paul Jones, or if I'm being 100% honest, a Martin Mendez from Opeth kind of bass tone. And it really comes through in some of the bridge parts and whatnot. So overall, from start to finish, this probably is my favorite track on the album, just because the vibe is, like, super great. Like, I love listening to it. So hopefully everybody will dig it.
Cool. Let's get into it. This is Shadow of the Snake. This is from the album Awakening by Blues Funeral. Check it out.
You're not supposed to have a favorite. They're all your children.
They are. But this one actually ended up being my favorite. It's not just...
Can I leave this in?
Yeah.
Okay.
not just because I wrote it, you know, but it is one of my favorites.
Time. Thank you.
Welcome back. We were just listening to a band called Ruby the Hatchet, unknown to you and I.
I've heard him before.
You've heard him before?
He's played him before on this show.
Oh, okay. All right.
You just weren't paying attention, apparently.
Song name Killer off the album. What was the album name again?
Planetary Space Child.
Yeah. I am having a bad night with names. I couldn't remember what the last Enslaved album was called.
Right. It's true.
I wanted to play this one for a couple different reasons. So one, they're actually releasing this record the same day we're releasing ours on the 25th. And two, it's actually very fitting that Shadow the Snake is juxtaposed with Ruby the Hatchet. I think I told you guys earlier I'd written this song originally right around, say, February 2015, just before South by Southwest, and I went to South by Southwest right around the time this song was finished to see Ruby the Hatchet and a bunch of other bands play The Lost Well for this thing called Heavy Metal Parking Lot.
Remember that?
That they were doing. It was great. Like, they did it the next year, and, like, Pentagram played and a bunch of other bands. We went to see Ruby the Hatchet, The Skull, and a couple of other bands. It was a great time, but I love what these guys are doing musically. Live, their keyboard player brings an actual organ on stage and plays through an actual Leslie, which I think is absolute madness, considering these guys tour the country, and that must be an awful chore, especially when the last time they played Houston was at Rudyard's, and you have to go up that stairwell of death. I mean, that's horrific if you're in a normal band. And I can only imagine what getting an organ up those stairs must entail.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah.
You know, granted, I'm sure he's cut parts of it out. We didn't have a very lengthy conversation about how that thing actually gets from one place
and
to another.
You get up to the top of the stairs, and you have to do that sharp turn, too.
Oh, my God. It's horrendous. So, I mean, that's amazing. Jillian is just a great person, and her stage presence nuts. Her vocals are crazy. This song, I told her when they were in town last, reminded me of a little bit of Blue Oyster Cult, you know, mixed with their own kind of mystical spell. And I love it. I think it's a great track. I'm really looking forward to the new record coming out on Friday.
So the album, of course, is called, again, is Planetary Space Child.
Yeah.
Coming out on Friday. Check it out. This Ruby the Hatchet. Very cool. So what's next for the show? Let's just get right into some more music, man.
Yeah, definitely.
Ready to get orchestrated here?
Sure. This is Death Metal's answer to Rhapsody.
That's an interesting way to put it.
You've had some good analogies tonight.
I've never been wild on Septic Flesh, which is strange for me loving Therion so much as much as I do. They're growing on me a little bit, but I've always just found them to be, whenever I hear them, all I can think of is just images from the movie The 300. Just like cycling through my mind, and I'm like, enough of this. It's just too much sometimes.
I think Septic Flesh is one of those bands that can mix movie orchestration well with some great fucking brutal death metal.
They separate the elements really well.
Yeah, it works really well together.
Yeah.
They play up the strengths and the dynamics of both of those forms and kind of meld them in a way that most other bands
try to
right.
unsuccessfully.
There's only one other band that I can think of, and that they have Flesh in the title too. I can't think of what they're called now.
Flesh God Apocalypse.
Flesh God Apocalypse. Thank you.
Yeah,
they're the only two bands in this genre that really are sort of doing it right. You know, of course, you had Dimmu Borgir mixing a lot of like the heavy orchestration, that kind of stuff, but it's a hard thing to try to do.
I mean, and like, you know, Epica, whenever they would have like actual more growling vocals back in the day.
I still like Epica a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I haven't kept up with them enough to really know what's going on. I probably know more about what Simone Simmons has done in Arion projects than I do in her own.
Yeah.
There you go. That's
she's
true.
She's always great in guest roles.
Yeah.
I always appreciate her presence in the guest spot.
She's got
same thing with Liv Christine.
Sure.
Same thing with Liv Christine. Very good in the guest spot. I don't think I can handle Leaves Eyes album all the way through. I just like, too much.
Neither. I guess I couldn't handle her anymore either. So she's gone.
Yeah, that's a thing. I was just thinking. I'm like, what is Liv Christine doing now? I guess just solo stuff.
I think so. Yeah.
I've heard something recently from her too. So, do you want to talk about that band I heard today on Spotify? Speaking of all female vocalists. Exit Eden.
Sure.
It's definitely a project that feels very forced to me. So it's Amanda Somerville.
Clementine DeLune.
From, what's her name?
Visions of Atlantis. Yeah. And she used to be in Serenity. She used to be in Ex Libris and stuff like that, yeah.
And two other vocals I don't know.
Yeah.
It's very over the top.
They're doing pop covers.
Yeah, they're covering pop
like,
covers.
Like Total Eclipse of the Heart.
And Lady Gaga.
And Lady Gaga.
Yeah.
I mean...
That sounds... I haven't listened to this band, but that sounds incredibly forced.
Well, it's an AFM Records, right?
Or
it's,
I don't know for that for sure.
It's either like Frontiers or AFM, which is like one of these labels has this thing where they just kind of like have a staff of writers, like songwriters on retainer, who knock out these songs for these kind of manufactured projects that get released throughout the year. And I mean, like Magnus Carlsen is one of those songwriters.
Oh yeah.
From Rage also, what's his name, is one of the guys too. Matt Sinner is one of the songwriters' staff, who's just like on staff. And it's like, okay, they just kind of knock out these things for, like, you know, for example, whenever Jorn Lande did the album with Russell Allen.
Mm-hmm. Well, he did multiple albums.
Those songs are written by just external guys, external right. songwriters from other bands. And it just kind of creates this weird album. And you're kind of like, all right, like this is, it's fun, but there's not really a lot of emotional connection to it because you're just kind of hearing just not generic rock, but just sort of like some kind of A&R.
It's AOR metal.
A&R project. Like,
right, yeah.
It's hard to get attached to it, you know?
So going back to the Septic Flesh, the album is called Codex Omega. Comes out September 1st. Season of Mist Records. Check it out.
Wow, they're on Season of Mist.
Yeah, let's get into the track. It's called Enemy of Truth, which we are not been the enemy of truth. We've been speaking very truthfully tonight.
All right.
Especially you. All right, check it out.
Yes.
Welcome back to episode 197 of MSRcast. I am Carry the Metal Geek, and we just listened to a brand new track from Stephen Wilson. the album is called To the Bone. The song we heard was the same Asylum as before. Very good stuff, man. I haven't actually heard this album yet.
I've heard the album. I got it on Friday, but I had heard the stream ahead of time. You know how much I love The Hand Cannot Erase.
Yes, I do.
We went on at length about how brilliant that album and the backstory around that album was and how affecting it was emotionally and everything. And this album, it doesn't have the same kind of gravitas to its backstory. It's not a concept album. It's a musical, like, thematic album because what he stated is that he's been inspired by albums that were like sophisticated pop albums from the 80s, like Peter Gabriel's albums or like certain Tears for Fears records or something, or Kate Bush albums.
I hear a lot of Genesis.
And yeah, stuff like that. And so he wanted to do something that was like a throwback to that, that was very poppy, but not like pop in the sense that you think of pop music today on the radio, but like sophisticated pop from, you know, like the 80s, like he's basically saying like, you know, the 80s got a bad rap, and in retrospect, there was a lot of great pop music back then. And metal, of course, we think of the 80s as kind of a classicist golden period.
Yeah.
But with, you know, Stephen Wilson, I know that it's not 100% metal now, but he's still worth talking about on the show just because of the pedigree that he has with metal fans. All of us love him, you know?
He's able to break those boundaries and you know... I mean, if you do an album with, you know, Michael Akerfeldt,
yeah,
that gives you some cred right there.
Yeah.
There's that street cred, man. But yeah, Porcupine Tree, if you don't know Stephen Wilson, it's sort of hard to
find. Are you listening to the show?
It's sort of hard to find a jumping in point.
This might be a good one.
Yeah, I think so.
It's definitely his most accessible album. Since maybe like Lightbulb Sun with Porcupine Tree, and
I was gonna say In Absentia.
In Absentia, I would say that's true. Because there's even shades of that album. I feel in moments on this song, little flourishes that feel very at home within the Porcupine Tree catalog.
Yeah, definitely.
Certain chord progressions that just have that trademark Porcupine Tree Steve Wilson flair to them.
It's his songwriting style. A lot of people, you know, when they do solo albums, they tend to do something completely different than what they do in the normal band, because that affords them the opportunity to branch out and try new things. And he's done that with some of his solo albums. But I think we talked about this when we were listening to it. It feels more like the last two albums feel more like he's doing Porcupine Tree albums without calling him Porcupine Tree.
I mean, definitely on... I think there's elements of that. I think saying that, though, sells it short a little bit. There's things thematically, musically, that I think he explored in some of his solo stuff that were not at home in Porcupine Tree, and that's why he's found this outlet in his solo career. Even on this, right? I mean, sure, this particular track has shades of Porcupine Tree in it, but I hear Steve doing things vocally that he's pushing himself a little bit. Like, he's exploring higher registers.
Oh, yeah.
I noticed that a lot, actually, while listening to this record. I was like, he's doing some things very different vocally than what I'm used to. And yet, it doesn't feel so intrusive or such a far departure from what is sort of typical Stephen Wilson, because that's just how he approaches songwriting. It's definitely a great album and a great tune.
Yeah, like vocally, because he doesn't really consider himself to be like a brilliant vocalist, but he's always kind of played it safe with his vocals. Like, he never like pushes himself out of a range, but here he's doing that. And like, you know, we were talking about Permanating, the kind of controversial yeah. single from the album, and how it is him singing the entire song in a very elevated register, and it's kind of alarming for the first time you hear it. But I'm a pop fan, so I love that kind of stuff. And I kind of relish the reaction it provoked from a lot of the diehard Stephen Wilson fans. It's just like poking them, sort of like you have to realize where that influence is coming from. He's a big fan of the Carpenters. He's a huge fan of ABBA. And if you don't hear those two bands in particular coming through in that song, you know, you're missing kind of the thread that connects all these things that influence him, you know? It's not just prog, it's pop, old classic pop too.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
I think it's an interesting thing in the metal community. Everybody wants to sort of be an iconoclast in a way and like leave room for experimentation, yet we have a very sort of predefined set of parameters that things have to adhere to. And it's such a fine line, right? Like you want to foster a certain amount of experimentation to see where something goes, but then the fear is always like, dude, is this going to be like Celtic Frost Cold Lake experimentation just gone wrong off the deep end? I don't think that's what's happened here, just to be clear, but I think that's where the fear comes from and why some of the backlash just happened so very quickly. Like, what's happening? Deviation. This is too many standard deviations away from the accepted, you know, median that we're used to.
It's what happened to that one band, the Suicide Silence, that had all that big controversy around there when they released that new single like half a year ago or whatever.
Yeah, I read about that, but see, I didn't know what they sounded like before, and I didn't know what they sound like now, so I can't speak to that, but I did read that it alienated like their whole entire fan base.
Yeah, they took a hit sales wise too. But I mean, good for Stephen Wilson.
At least they were doing what they wanted to do.
No, for sure.
Good for Stephen Wilson. He's number one in the UK midweek charts apparently right now.
That's good.
So somehow this could translate into the first underground prog artist hitting the mainstream in a huge way.
But see, this is the thing. Like, we were kind of talking about this a little bit too. I don't think he's that underground. I mean,
that's true.
He's played like what, Voodoo Fest and possibly Lollapalooza, which arguably are fairly mainstream festivals.
Lollapalooza?
Yeah. It was either Voodoo or Lolla or both.
Well, I mean, yeah, you're right. He's still a little underground, but he's at the higher end of being underground. People know his name.
Right.
Now, I think going solo and breaking away from just using the Porcupine Tree name has allowed him to become a bigger artist, I think. You know, because now people know his name instead of a collective name, you know?
I mean, it wasn't guaranteed, because when he was releasing, like, Grace for Drowning and The Raven Refused, he had to build it back up. He had the Porcupine Tree fans that knew him from that band. But going without that, you know, brand name, he had to build his own brand name up again. And the fact that he's eclipsing the success, like, Grace for Drowning is his biggest selling record in his career. But the fact that he's transcended that success to such a point where he could possibly have a UK number one album, that's a big deal. In the Facebook advertisements that they're throwing all around for this album, the tagline that his PR company has put is that Stephen Wilson is the biggest UK artist you've never heard of.
That's interesting.
And I could see that. But I mean, the fact that this guy could be on BBC, you know, BBC One radio, and that he could be played on, he can get a spot at Top of the Pops and shit like that. It's like, wow, that's just, to me, it's surreal to think I saw this guy in the engine room in 2005, you know, and I got to like watch them sound check and stuff.
Now, for him to get that level of recognition here in the States, that people are not fans of Porcupine Tree, you don't know who he is already, he has to get one of these songs on, not just on Spotify, but one of their
terrestrial radio.
Well, that, but it needs to be on Spotify, but it needs to be on one of those, here's not the new metal tracks or your release radar. It needs to be on that top pop type of stuff. And here's...
Permanating is a song that could do it.
Yeah.
But anytime in the Porcupine Tree, in their history, well, they really pushed a song called Shallow, which was off an album called Dead Wing. They pushed it so hard that it actually dented American mainstream rock radio, actually hit the charts there, number 20 or something.
I will admit that's the first song I
heard
it
on the freaking radio station here in Houston. Yeah, and they played it in the theater. I remember as like a, you know, one of those preview songs you play before the movie starts. So they had a push for that, and he even talks about in some interviews how they spent a lot of money on that, and it just stalled out. So anytime that they've tried to push something, it stalls out. But this might be the first one where they can actually successfully do it.
I mean, I think the other thing, too, to really break into mainstream America, you have to pound the pavement. It's been a while since we've seen any sort of a Stephen Wilson tour in the U.S. And arguably, while he was doing it with Porcupine Tree, it only happened a handful of times over a span of a lot of years.
Yeah, and anytime he does a U.S. tour, he always skips Texas, which, in my opinion, doesn't make it a real U.S. tour, because you got to hit these are huge markets.
For sure.
Not even saying just because I want to see them. I'm just saying that don't call it a U.S. tour. Enslaved.
Yeah.
The very gall of these guys calling it a U.S. tour and not
Gall's
hitting,
not in that band.
Not hitting one.
Dude,
not hitting,
Gall's not in that band.
Not hitting one freaking city in Texas.
Yeah. That's true. They did not.
The other thing, too, from a packaging perspective, Steven, I feel, has historically come with folks that either share his status, meaning relatively unknown for your point, you know, within Porcupine Tree, etc.
Yeah.
Or whatever. But he needs to be touring with somebody that's bigger than him that can bring him out and give him a little bit more exposure.
He hasn't opened for anyone. Like, he opened for Yes, like in Europe a while ago, I think.
But not in the States is my
point.
But
not in the States.
The last time I remember him in the States, he came out with Big Elf and they played House of Blues.
Right.
And that's a band that hardly anybody knows about, which is shocking
because
they're great. But
right. You know, like you guys just saw Deep Purple. I mean, I could see that being a good avenue for him.
It can be a great band for him to tour with.
Yeah, and the thing is, I think he's at that place where he's, I only want to tour in the way I want to tour and venues that I want to play in, not amphitheaters, that kind of thing. So he's just sort of walked into the fact that he is successful. He can make a living doing it. Why should I go try to break, you know, to break myself to try to break America, that kind of thing, which I respect. If he can break England, that's all he needs, I guess, you know.
So moving on, so did you guys see the eclipse today?
I did.
Did not you? Really. I stayed indoors.
Yeah, it was it was eclipsy. Yeah. But it led me to want to play this song on this episode because there's that picture of our president looking straight up at the eclipse. So the next song we're going to play, it's one of my favorite British prog bands. It's a band called Threshold, who have a new album coming out, and they have their original vocalist back in the band. Damon Wilson is no longer a vocalist in the band, but the song we're going to play, it's from an album that Damon Wilson sang on called March of Progress, and the song is titled Staring at the Sun. I think it was pretty appropriate, especially with that photo going around social media today. This is one of my favorite songs from this album, so let's get into some Threshold. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to MSRcast 197. You're listening to From the Flame by Leprous from the album Molina.
Molina.
Yeah. Which, if that guy's voice sounded familiar and you were watching the Vakken live stream, which is all over YouTube now, you can just go watch it anytime you want to. He's the backing vocalist that was playing keyboards during Emperor's set.
That's right.
That made Thus Spake the Night Spirit sound so freaking epic.
He's also the queen vocal. He's also his brother-in-law.
He is the brother-in-law, yeah. He's Ariel's brother, Ariel from Pacadam.
Yes.
Yes.
So, yeah, he's if you don't know, Leprous is also the backing band for Isan.
Yeah.
For all of his albums. So, totally different sound now, but you can definitely hear it.
Yeah.
I like them a lot. This is the first song I've heard off the new album. But yeah, speaking of doing some higher registers, he really does.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely had, we're kind of talking about this, a little bit more of a pop sensibility than I was expecting. I haven't listened to too much of their stuff and don't have a keen awareness of their sound outside of the fact that I know, you know, they've done the backing thing for Aizen, but interesting stuff. I'll have to check it out.
You said you didn't like the Matt Heafy stuff with the Aizen. did you, but I love that song. It was
How do you say it?
I say Aizen.
I've always said Isan.
Okay.
We'll have to...
Three ways.
Potato, potato, whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
But that song, Mass Darkness, that he's on.
Yes.
I love that song so much.
I have such a problem with him collaborating with Matt Heafy. I just can't even deal with it.
I even liked Heafy's contributions on that Dragon Force album 2 years ago, where he was on a couple... He did some vocals for a couple of those albums. That. You remember.
I don't remember.
We played it on the show.
I don't remember, though. I blocked it out or something.
All right.
You're the one telling me that every time you see Trivium, you're fucking hand in the air. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. My favorite band. This is a fallacy that's been proliferated by many of my friends on the internet.
You know, I really did like their very first album when they first came out with Ember to something. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I enjoyed that album. I thought it was a good, but then they changed very quickly.
We're living in a strange and exciting time where artists that I really want to have nothing to do with and don't ever want to have to acknowledge that I like any of their creative input are finding their way into songs where I have to pause for a second and say, you know, okay, that wasn't that bad. Like Marty Friedman just dropped his new album fairly recently within the last couple of weeks.
Yeah.
He actually just played Scout Bar a couple of nights ago, killed it. And one of the collaborations that he has on this record is one of the cats from that awful band Black Veil Brides.
Oh, God.
Yeah. The dude's name is Jinx, which already I have a problem with. I mean, like, unless you look like Nikki Sixx, I don't know that you can. And maybe he does. I don't even know enough. But
I think they all do look like Nikki Sixx.
Even then, I'm like, whatever. Turns out this guy plays violin. And plays it pretty well. And I was listening to Marty's new record. I hadn't even thumbed through the booklet yet. And I'm like, oh, Marty must have collaborated with, you know, some fantastic classically trained Japanese violin player.
Yo-Yo Ma.
Because he loves violin. And then I'm like, dude, it's the dude Jinx from Black Veil Brides. I feel unclean. I liked that moment. No.
I watched a video with Marty Friedman today for Metal Injection. It was an interview with him, but they went to like this. Apparently he's said in interviews before he doesn't really like bacon. They took him to a restaurant that all they serve is bacon to try to change his mind. Spoiler alert, he changes his mind. He likes bacon now. It's a pretty great interview if you need to check that out. It's on their YouTube page.
But yeah, no, it's nuts. I mean, I feel like this is happening more and more. I feel like it's a marketing ploy for a lot of people, but more and more people are reaching out across the aisle to do strange collaborations with people you wouldn't expect to see working together. It's interesting.
I'll give Heafy some credit. He has like black metal like knowledge credibility as a fan. Like he wears
a Burzum t-shirt from time to time. That knowledge does not make good, sir.
I've heard in interviews, like he does seem to be like a dyed in the wool fan. Like he is a legitimate fan of this stuff. So it's like, okay, whenever he like name drops stuff like that, like how he's a fan of Emperor or whatever, I'm like, all right.
So okay, I believe you. I am going to say something. Somehow I started following him on Spotify, Matt Heafy, and I will tell you this, he listens to Trivium a lot on his Spotify account. I think that's very, very strange.
I think that's
very telling.
I think that's got to be something that they plug in there. Just like,
I have no idea. It's a marketing ploy.
I don't
want to
believe that he's sitting there listening to his own band.
He's sitting there in his living room just going, "Do you know what a circle pit is? Oh, I'm that heavy." While listening to his own recording. I just know. I can't abide.
Is he calling people to do circle pits and during those shows? Is he one of those guys?
That's one of those memories that I have. No. It was like, it was a tour with them, Bodum and Amona Marth or something at the Meridian a few years back, and I literally just remember standing in the middle of the room and hearing him be like, "Do you know what a circle pit is?" And I'm just like, "Oh my god, this."
That was early in their career, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
I think I was at that show.
Yeah, it was.
Was he say Children of Boredom and who else? that slipped out.
Amona Marth.
I remember that show. It was a label tour or something, wasn't it?
I don't remember if it was a label tour or not, but it was maybe one that of the first, second, third times I'd seen Amona Marth or something like that.
Okay.
Sounds like
Metal Blade tour, maybe.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah,
I feel like it was. It was like there was a band they were trying to break on the tour, you know.
Trivium.
Yeah.
Only Millie can get away with like crowd directions. Like, all right, you guys, you stay over here, and you guys come over here, and we're gonna do Wall of Death.
It's time to raise the flag of hate.
Yeah.
He did that a lot. It was pretty great.
It's awesome. I mean, he's got like the digital delay on his voice, even while he's giving his little like stage banter directions. You stun, dun, dun, dun.
So let's bring this. I've always wondered this question. I've asked these people. So, do you like between song banter in a normal voice, or do you like it in their like death metal voice?
Always normal voice.
Like Michael Akerfeldt. He can do the most brutal fucking vocals and thank you very much.
Yeah, we are Opeth from Stockholm, Sweden.
It does depend on the band, though, I think.
Yeah.
Like, I think Creator, and you know, like, for example, Creator, it's kind of exciting when he does that, you know? But
it's also still intelligible.
It's intelligible.
Not like some of these black metal dudes who I remember seeing some shows that were, like, super underground at, like, Engine Room where only 5 people were in attendance. And you just hear this guy and he's like, "We have t-shirts for sale in the back of the room, and we're going to be playing another show at the White Swan on the 13th, and there's going to be a t-shirt contest to follow."
You know who you sound like there? You sound like that comedian guy that was on Independence Day.
Which guy?
Do you know who I'm talking about?
No.
I can't think of his name now, but he's like the gay comedian guy.
The gay comedian guy in Independence Day?
Yeah.
The first one?
The first. Yeah, Fire something. Firestein? Harvey Firestein.
Who does he play in Independence Day?
He was like the brother or something. He dies early in the movie. He was
like the original Independence
Day? Yeah,
the
original. He was Jeff Goldblum's brother.
Jeff Goldblum had a brother in that movie?
Wasn't it a coworker or something?
Challenging
coworker.
My memory here.
Yeah, I'm like,
we watched Independence Day recently, like in July when it was on TV.
So I don't recall Goldblum having a brother.
Yeah.
Look what you've done. You guys derailed.
I've blown your mind. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I'm going to go home and watch that awful movie tonight.
Death and...
There you go.
Death and black metal bands.
I think he's dead now, too, isn't he? Yeah.
Oh, that dude. Yeah, he was the co-worker. He was in Mrs. Doubtfire, too.
Yeah, Mrs. Doubtfire. He had that weird, like...
Throaty, gravelly
voice. Sounded like your black metal voice, sir.
Fair enough.
He could have been in a black metal band. We didn't know.
Possibly could have.
Yeah, I cringe every time a death or black metal band does that. Like, when they're just, like, doing, like, crowd banter in between.
It's like one thing if the crowd banter is done in largely a normal voice, and then maybe you, like, add a little brutality just to announce the song title. Acceptable, yeah. Crossing a line, it's a fine line.
We could probably do a show on all these faux pas, but one of the faux pas is if you're a local band, like, you know, like a relatively unknown band, no one gives two fucks about your song titles. Just get into the song.
Yeah.
I'm not going to remember it past the 2 seconds you just said it.
You know, you're sitting next to a guy in a local band, right?
Like, no, these guys are hitting like national, international, like audiences. Like but the thing is, like, if you're a local band and you're telling me that your song title is like Thunderous Waves of Descent, I don't care. Just play the song. You know what I mean? Impress me, man.
But then after they finish that song, you're like, oh, fuck, I wish I knew the name of that song.
Either. You can go up to them and talk to them afterwards and go, what was that song you played? Oh, Thunderous Waves of Descent? Yeah.
This sounds like a hidden gem that you've been holding on to for an unreleased album that you're planning on putting out. Or maybe it's the album title. What was it again, Carrie? Thunderous Waves of Descent?
I'm writing it down.
Be sure to talk to Sean after the show about his upcoming release, Thunderous Waves of Descent.
I have a lot of... and, you know, the first guy who really illuminated me was Mikhail Akerfeld, seeing Opeth back in 2001, 2002, or whatever.
Did he tell you to call it Thunderous Waves of Descent at the time?
No, but just it was so alarming to see a guy, like, address the crowd in a normal voice and be kind of self-deprecating. And I was like, wow, I really, like, appreciate this. This is interesting. You're not talking to me like I'm a dumbass, you know, or going, hello, Houston, you know, and it's like 500 people in the room.
I remember. You
know? It's like, no.
You remember, like, about, you know, when the, do you remember when the Anvil documentary broke, maybe like, what, 6-7 years ago?
Yeah.
They did a free, they did a $5 show at House of Blues, and I went to it. And I remember the lead guy, Lips, he started talking about, oh, thank you, Austin, blah, blah, blah. And the guitar player walks up to him. He's like, psh, 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 psh. He's like, oh, I mean, Houston. I was like, holy fuck. The first time I'd ever seen that, nobody, he didn't know where the fuck he was, you know?
That would be a faux pas.
That's funny. But yeah, know the hell you're playing.
Yeah.
Following that thunderous wave of descent,
yes.
If you were going to start a band, what would you call it?
Thunderous Wave of Descent.
Okay.
Simple.
Simple. I'd like to start a band called Goat Pelt, I feel. Clearly, there's a direction.
$5 goat
in,
belt.
In the wardrobe department that I'm thinking about there.
Goat Pelt.
Maybe I'll do that one day.
Goat, I'm sure there's been like goat blood and goat's blood. And
I feel like the word goat has been added to every other word possible.
There's a goat snake. I remember that.
Definitely. It's actually a good band.
Yeah, it is a good band.
But I'm sure you could pretty much take any word and...
Okay, I'm going to change my name. It's Thunderous Waves of Goat.
I like it.
That was good, right? It works.
You can also interchange it. Goat Waves of Descent.
There you go. How about Zombie Bear?
Thunderous Goat Descent.
That sounds like a good album title.
Yeah.
I think we've pulled the next Blues Funeral album title right now.
Thunderous Goat Descent.
That's right.
We need to get some artwork made for this.
Definitely.
A couple t-shirts.
It's going to be like Odin or somebody from Valhalla throwing down a lightning bolt with goats on it.
Yes.
In a wave crashing down on the earth.
Of dissension.
Exactly.
Yeah. We're done.
It's planned.
That's it. Concept album.
Or it could just be like a scene of like a local band playing in front of a couple people and the lead singer just kind of like pointing out.
That's true. So I guess thanks for tuning in to the latest episode of MSR Cast. Thank you to our special guest, Maurice from Blues Funeral.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Check out the brand new album called Awakening, out available this Friday, the 25th. Is that the date?
It is.
Check him out if you're here in Houston. Come see him live. You know, smoke a little something and then get psychedelic with him.
Yeah,
you know?
Why not?
You know what I'm saying? So we have one more song we're going to play, but let's talk about our social media locations and all that. We'll start with our guest first, of course.
Sure, yeah. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Bandcamp, videos on YouTube, all that good stuff.
At Blues Funeral for all that good stuff.
Yes.
Bluesfuneral.bandcamp.com is where you can purchase the first album, and starting Friday, the second album, right?
Yep, absolutely.
Support. What about The Metal Pigeon?
Yeah, The Metal Pigeon, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, the www.themetalpigeon.com.
There you go. And for us, of course, MSRcast on all the social medias, on the Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, MSRcast.com, or you can go to metalgeeks.net for both of our shows all in one location. Subscribe to us on the iTunes or on Stitcher. Leave us a review. 5-star reviews are the best because it does really help let other people know about the show. And we are coming up very close to episode number 200 of the show. Just celebrated 5 years of Metal Geeks this past week. So that episode just came out. And I've been doing this show for 12 years. Going on 12 years now, man.
Yeah.
Damn, it's awesome.
Yeah, so only 200 episodes in 12 years. We need to step that shit up.
Yeah.
Let's do like 8 more episodes tonight. We'll be good to go, right? But what's the last song we're going to be listening to tonight? It's another song that Maurice brought.
Yeah, so the band is Necromanda. It's kind of an interesting story behind this band. They were poised to release their first album on Vertigo back in like 73, and Tony Iommi from Sabbath was actually producing it. Then one of the key members ended up leaving the band. They ended up getting dropped from the label. And it's only been through, you know, some subsequent re-releases that first collection of songs kind of saw the light of day. But this is actually an album that these guys released this year in 2017.
Yeah. Wow.
And I mean, it's a great album because it's got a really great kind of collection of vibes, very much rooted in the 60s and 70s. This track in particular kind of starts off with more of a sort of chilled out progressive vibe that then builds into stuff that starts to kind of get a little more up-tempo as some pretty raging guitar solos kind of kick in. But this is another one of the albums that's ranking pretty high on my list of the year for 17 so far.
Very cool. And the album title is, what is it?
Necromandus.
Necromandus is self-titled. Yeah. Wow.
The eponymous album.
So 44 years later, they finally put an album out?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, wait, they didn't have an album out in the 70s?
No, it never actually like officially got released.
Jesus, wow.
Because they got dropped from the label. I mean, they were about to get support of all support, right? Tony Iommi from Black Sabbath. Huh. And they were going to be on Vertigo.
So what happened? Did they just had a dissension in the band?
Yeah, it was just like one of the key members left.
So yeah, pulled dissension back out.
Thunderous waves of dissension
in the band.
Did that key member come back in?
Yeah, I think he did.
Okay.
That's crazy. That's a great story.
So did they have like a demo out, like to build like the lore behind them or something?
Well, I mean, I think there were like various bootlegs and things that were released of the original collection of songs. And then it was kind of put out on a record that people have sort of termed Orexis of Death, whatever. I think that's what it's been called, Orexis of Death. And I mean, great, great stuff. Great 70s material. But yeah, they came back and put this one out this year, and it's in this style probably one of the best records that's come out in a while, in my opinion.
Well, let's check that out, and thanks for checking out this latest episode of MSRcast, and I think we have so much more music to play, we'll invite you back to the next episode.
Awesome, man. Yeah, would love to do it.
All right, man. Well, thanks for hanging out with us, and as we say to all of our fans and our guests on the show, keep it metal.
Let's do it. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to another fine podcast brought to you by MSR Productions. All rights reserved, blah, 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 blah. For reviews, archives of our podcasts, and all your other metal geekery needs, please visit metalgeeks.net. Keep it geeky. Keep it metal.